listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage, Regional Originals, brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is John Tracy. John works internationally as a director, playwright, designer, educator, and facilitator. He's the recipient of the Kennedy Center Meritorious Achievement Award and has directed at the Magic Theater, Shotgun Players, SF Playhouse, Marin Theater Company, Aurora Theater, Berkeley Playhouse, Marin Shakespeare Company, Impact Theater, and many, many others. He is also the co-founder of SF Playhouse The Sandbox, a development model for new plays. He's a company member of Playground, as well as Shotgun Players. And he is the artistic facilitator for Theater First, co-artistic director of Groundswell, the International Theater Intensive, and a proud member of SDC, the Union for Stage Directors and Choreographers, and the sponsor of this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thank you so much.
The first question I want to ask is, where did you grow up and how did you find the theater?
I didn't grow up far from here. Right now we're in Berkeley.
Yeah, we're in your theater.
Yeah.
We're in Theater First.
Yeah. I grew up in the North Bay, Vallejo, California. From there, I was one of those kids. I think my story is sometimes maybe on the nose. right about 10 or 11, I was just that kid that didn't quite fit into the grooves. And I was just reaching out, looking for something. And a friend of mine, one of the few I felt I had, said, I'm doing this theater thing. Theater thing sounded sort of exciting to me. I'd seen a production of Robin Hood when I was 8, and excited by the ideas, and I said, no, sure, I'm gonna go do this thing. And in some ways, I never looked back. I came in to the Vallejo Youth Conservatory and made my friends for life. Understood very quickly that this was a place where I could be a part of a community, and I'll even admit at first, perhaps the theater was secondary to the community that it handed me.
Yeah.
And it was also interesting that as I moved into high school, and it felt like certainly many more hours were being dedicated to theater than to my grades. It was also the time in Vallejo with a lot of economic depression, and it seemed that even my educators were pushing me more towards something that they saw passion for, rather than this system that was deconstructing in front of our faces. So things like my Spanish teacher saw that I was coming in exhausted every day, and at one point said to me, you're getting a C- in this class. I want you to go to the back of the room when you get here, and there's a couch there, and go to sleep for the hour. I want to know you got an hour of sleep. That's amazing on one hand that you're being held in those ways. My Spanish is terrible. But
your theater is magic.
Well, it certainly led me to one big decision, which was also that of perhaps youthful naivete, which was, I am never going to have a job outside of the theater. I said that when I was 16 or 17 years old. And so a pledge was made.
Yeah.
And a path was set. And a whole lot of obstacles in the way. The most fantastic part of that was, if I was going to do that, I really had to learn how to do everything. So my early years there were certainly, you know, you're trotting the boards, but you're also learning a little something about what it is to stage manage and light design and fight choreograph and set design and on and on and on and on and on. And in order to do that, you just have to be listening. And I feel like my path was very much about listening and luck, because I was able to be in rooms where the folks inside were worth listening to. And those folks had a lot of patience for someone who was just trying to figure things out moment for moment. And it became my school. And it's a schooling that's never, has had no end to it whatsoever. The really challenging part of this choice, though, was in order to literally make ends meet, like to pay the rents, to eat the food, was I had to take everything, just everything that came my way.
Yeah.
And there's an addiction there, and there's a lack of awareness when you're so focused on the basics. You're not looking at what sort of identity as an artist that you're sculpting out for yourself.
Right.
And when you're like, why am I getting this type of gig over and over? Well, you know, you've opened yourself up to everything.
Yeah.
And it actually, a few, 10 years ago, I'm throwing that number out.
Yeah.
Anything, was really a moment where I made another pact, which was, stop this.
Wow.
This isn't good for you in your health.
Yeah.
You are doing work that you don't believe in.
Yep.
And you need to not... Yes, it's very exciting. It's very romantic to say, I did 12 plays last year, or something absurd like that, which is completely absurd. But when you... Would it be possible to step back, look at the stories that mean something to you, ask yourself deep questions. Those same questions you thought you were asking everyone else, maybe you needed to start asking of yourself.
Yeah,
and
that's such a big turn.
It was a huge turn. It was a scary turn, and it certainly wasn't like, well, okay, great, John, you want to pick and choose. By all means, do that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're not at our disposal anymore? Well, here's a year with nothing.
Right.
What do you do then? And you wait it out. You focus on what brought you there in the first place. Not what I said before about the community.
Yeah.
What really brought you there in the first place?
There's
a lot of places you can build community. Why this? What was the magic of telling a story? And what were the stories that I was willing to tell? And I felt like I started over. And it's the best choice that I ever made. And I started to go back to the ideas that were taught to me by some of my mentors. Just start going back to find the hole in the wall. Find the space where you can craft out passion pieces.
Yeah.
Even if there's no budget to them.
Yeah.
But you can do them in your time and your way, and you can have a workshop space. And then have a different hat for when you need to get in the room with others and listen and learn and join conversations and begin to create a network of folks in which you feel like you want to be bouncing off of, that you want your identity to be a reflection of.
Yeah.
And that was a fascinating group of years working with some fantastic companies, large and small. And then, and I know I'm taking this and then there was another moment of doubt, which was looking back at what now felt a little bit like a career. And that's maybe there's a, I'm going to take a side note off of that, which is, it's interesting. I'm really actually dealing with this right now as I, you know, you think about those moments that inspire you. And I remember being inspired being in Italy years ago and looking at Da Vinci's work and looking at this, how many drafts of things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And the concept of being able to draft and draft and draft. And I don't know if it's consciously, subconsciously, I started thinking about my plays as drafts. Everything was a sketch and a draft. And we're building and building and building and building and building and building. And there's beauty there. There's also something when you look back and go, well, give or take, I'm halfway through my life right now. And is there going to be a point when I stop thinking of these as sketches? Mm. And these, is there a moment when this is my work? Or was it my work all along?
Yeah.
And could it have been no... Had I thought of it as my work then, where would I have, where would I have been able to bring those stories? It's a conundrum that I've been just trying to unpack lately. But my moment of doubt really came five-ish years ago, when I started really looking at the career that I'd had and the career that I have as a cis white male.
Yeah.
And starting to look at all those rooms I was able to get in very easily, all those moments of luck, and realizing I should be a bit suspicious of all of those moments and all of the... Every time that, and with all love and respect to the theater companies that I'm about to in some way talk about.
Yeah.
The thing that I received over and over again, I would be hired by a company. I would do the best work I could do. Maybe it wasn't good. Maybe it was okay. Maybe there was some space between what I did and what they wanted. And when I received... in return was, well, John, let's try again. Here's another show. Do that show. Well, John, we got here, we got there. Let's try another show and another show. And the patience that folks gave me and the faith that folks gave me is why I have a career at all. It's why my resume is extremely long, because I was given this gift over and over and over again. With no disrespect to those organizations, I have to look at what privilege had to do with those experiences and those choices and those gives and those gifts. Because, you know, here in the Bay Area, where we have a lot to talk about, these words, this acronym, the EDI. We have a lot we want to talk about. We have a lot we want to unpack. And it wasn't until that conversation got a little louder that I started to really question it in the first place. And I was looking at how these mission and vision statements seemed to actually not bring us any closer to representation.
In reality. Yeah.
And actually might be working specifically to keep folks like me in the center.
Mm-hmm.
I will go on the record saying I, of the E, the D, and the I only back up the E.
And maybe we should just say the E, the D, and the I are the equity, diversity, and inclusion. Yeah.
The diversity, the problem with any word, of course, is it starts to serve whatever purpose you need to.
Yeah.
We just have to continuously unpack those ideas. The idea of that in my time, I've watched the word diversity just mean just about whatever it means to mean. Yeah. And the first thing that you have to ask is like, well, diversifying from what? And what is still at the center that you're diversifying from? And inclusion, who's doing this including? And simultaneously, and another step of inclusion is like, I keep hearing this, all voices, let's include all voices. Well, there's actually plenty of voices that we do not want to include. The idea of being a non-biased art is really dangerous as well. So this was a big moment where I needed to figure out what I'd done. I looked back at some of the shows that I'd been offered and some of the shows I'd taken, which I certainly would not take to this day, and starting to really do some introspection and trying to figure out how to turn that into actions. And it came at a time when I wanted to look at the art from a different lens. I had been a freelance director for a long time with a hat off to the side in producing and developing. But it was interesting for me to look at taking over a theater company. Not start another one from the ground up, but to see in this conversation about equity and representation, what it would take to take an existing company that had a relatively traditional construct, and what it would be to completely dismantle it, and how you would communicate with an audience, how you would communicate with artists, how you would open up this conversation in this way. And that's why I took over Theater First.
Yeah,
that's why I've been. That's what I've been doing for the last few years. And trying to figure out what my narrative within that is, and letting the narrative of what we're attempting to do be larger than myself.
Yeah.
So from Vallejo to this moment in Berkeley, there's my life.
Let's talk about Theater First, since we're there, and dismantling. I mean, you and I think have had some chats in the past, and we've kind of talked about, I think I've used this really maybe labored house repair metaphor, and the house is of course America, or the American theater. And it's like, oh well, there's something wrong with my sink, I'm gonna get in there, figure out what's wrong, and you're like, oh, there's racism all in the plumbing of this house. We've got to take the plumbing out, and then once you open up the wall to get into the plumbing, you're like, oh well, there's sexism throughout all of these walls and in the ceilings, and there's homophobia, and as the more you take apart, like the more you realize that the whole institution, the whole American theater kind of model, it needs to be reconstructed and dismantled and reconstructed. Mm-hmm. It all looked great, right? As you were saying, the whole edifice looked great from the outside, this house, until you realize, oh, well, it looks great to a certain kind of person. It looks great to a white, straight, cis man.
Yeah.
And so where do we start? You're the artistic facilitator, not artistic director, which I think is interesting, of Theater First, which is a small and mighty company that's flipping the script on how to dismantle traditional social workplace privilege structures, decenter whiteness, decolonize the way creation works. Can you talk about what you're doing at Theater First, just kind of broadly, or, you know, in any of the development work on new plays that you're doing?
Sure. To touch a couple of things you said, I mean, the moment you say, oh, we need to fix this problem, you're saying there's some part of it that's worth keeping.
Right? Yes. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about this.
Yeah. and there isn't. Honestly, if we need to, if we're going to be a part of coalitions that we can believe in, we have to start back at the beginning and look at that. Look at the first choice. I say coalitions is actually something that I. Funny, I started theater because I needed a community, I continue to do theater because of my belief in coalitions and not in community. And it's a word choice.
What's the split?
Well, the split has to do with my concerns with the word empathy.
Okay.
I see this as a word that's thrown around all the time in the theater right now.
Yeah.
And I get it. I get the attempt. But when looking at especially the privileged classes in which I have experienced and identified with, empathy has been one of the most dangerous weapons in the box, right? This idea of I can understand your struggle. If I work hard enough or if I listen long enough, I can understand your struggle. I want to walk a mile in your shoes. Mm-hmm. And the reality that has hit not only theoretically for me, but just really being able to experience deeply, profoundly, and with great humility is I don't know your struggle. I don't. I will never know your struggle. And the idea that if I can't understand your struggle, then I can't help you, is weird. And terrifying and sad. Really, if you're walking a mile in somebody's shoes, you've just a mile away from that person, and you've stolen their shoes, you know? So to me, the way that community was defined by me was we're sharing each other's struggle. And I understand where we're going with that, but I'd rather spend my energy looking at the space between us and saying that we can still use the tool of empathy, not to become one another, but to carve a very clear space between us.
Yeah.
And because you need to be able to be you without my judgment, without my love, without even my support, right?
Right.
And I need to be able to figure out me. And these are two affinity spaces where we're setting
That's
one
right.
another. And that there's this. And I don't consider myself a spiritual person necessarily, but I do. I think the closest I'll get to it is the space that we carve out between us is the church in which we meet.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It says that there we're carving out a space of speech, a space of ears listening,
mm-hmm.
a space where we can dream together, even perhaps even bleed together, perhaps demolish things together. But it can only happen when we understand we are not one another.
Right.
I'm gonna butcher a Che Guevara concept on the word comrade.
Okay.
And the problem with the word comrade is that you need to define comrade as being in the exact same danger as another person.
Mm.
And no matter what I do.
Yeah.
No matter whom I next to, most of the folks that we work with and I work with and I try to support here at Theater First, I would never, ever be in the same danger, no matter what's happening.
Yeah.
And these are all things, just these are all my truths. Theater First itself, the first idea was like, before anything can happen, let's just look at what the makeup of the people at Theater First needs to be. Because not one more decision can be made. and the simple mandate that started was the board, the staff, independent contractors, the narratives, two-thirds POC, at least 50% feminine identified, and at least one-third LGBTQIA2. So the first place, of course, that was let's look at the board. Just look at the board, because this is where the decision making tank needs
the power
to be.
Is.
Right. And so once those ratios were there, a conversation began, and choices and viewpoints started to figure out what would be next. So we were looking at a bunch of the theater companies around the Bay, and looking at mission statements that were just like blasting out all of these catchphrases, and seeing things that were really questionable. Like, hey, look, yeah, it's really nice that you can throw out that your last four shows were over 50% POC. But yeah, let's look a little deeper than that and say, but it's over 50% POC telling classically white stories. So what was the... What was the collision there? What was the expression there? Was that, how were you doing that? Or were you basically just having persons of color tell white stories? Which,
yeah,
most of the time that was that. Or you're doing this piece by this queer playwright or this artist of color, but who's telling that story? Who's amplifying that story? As the case may be, as it turns out, most of the time, the folks at the center of the storytelling did not identify with the story being told. So, well, that's where we need to start. So we decided the first thing would be, we wouldn't only be new works, we would be from the ground up. Meaning that we were commissioning, we weren't even taking first drafts of plays, we were taking ideas, and going, okay, let's look, we understand every story needs to be told in a different way with a different construct, so let's just start with these ideas and figure and spend the time to talk with the creator of this idea, and what do you need? What do you need around you? What's the first orbit? What's the second orbit? What's the third orbit? What's the trajectory for a year? What does that look like? What are we not thinking of? And that became, what I'm saying right now became, and has been our way of working, which is no answers anymore. Let's ask a hard enough question that by the time we get anywhere on it, we're just to a harder one, and a harder one, and a harder one. And if that's true, then what does this mean? And there's admittedly be some times when I'm like, if that's true, well, what does this mean? Meant, whoa, no, actually, we played that one out. We got to a spot that we found ourselves as sort of doubling back on old-ish, and we realized we made some mistakes. So, like, great, okay, so let's go back. We've learned that. What's the question out of that? Most of the time was, how do we make sure we see that coming next time?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh. Can you say, like, a specific example of that?
I think there was one time, I'll be a little bit general,
yeah,
just because I like everyone to have their own say if I'm ever bringing folks up, but there was, but this will lead to some really lovely things. There was a one piece that we worked on that was it was our first look at plurality. What would plurality mean? And if we're being very specific that we are being plural in this moment and what it was to have multiple, still working within our mandates, which we had to watch after this because we realized just because you're in your mandates does not mean you're actually having representation on stage in the way that you want to. What it was to honor one identity through multiple identities, and that was wrong. The way that we went about it was not clear. It hurt people. Mm-hmm. And no matter what your intentions are, when you hurt people, especially people within your coalition, that you believe in, you have done wrong.
Yeah.
And I think there's just no two ways about that. But no, there's no buts. When you've hurt someone, you've done wrong, and you need to acknowledge that wrong, and you need to come up with actions in order to make sure that wrong doesn't happen again. It leads me to the most powerful thing that has kept Theater First moving forward, which is these amazing humans, these amazing voices, that have braved communicating with me, with Theater First, when they see things not holding the standard that we have pushed out there to the world. And I think that's something I think we've been good about, is that the statements we make are not answers. They're things for you to hold us to. And there have been certain, and I'm just going to name one, that Regina Victor, the amazing artist, they...
Chicago-based now, here
for a while, but there is a larger coalition.
Yes.
And they, and their bravery, and their artistry, and their ability to articulate was a voice that had critique, but never without love.
Yeah.
And never without listening, and a conversation that started years ago continues to this day.
That's great.
And without folks like Regina, Theater First would be nowhere. And there are many more to name, but if I got started, I'd be here till next week.
So just to set it up, so Theater First, everything that you decide to do, is everything destined for a production? Are you committing to that, or are there just workshop kind of things where you're like, let's just work on this and see what happens, and there's that incubator as well.
We set out towards a full developmental production. We rehearse everything.
That's awesome.
Through to whatever you want to call closing night. I like to call them showings rather than anything else, but they are opened to audience because it's a major part of the development process. But we also have a family of audience these days that come to opening and come multiple times throughout to watch the development of a piece of work, which is a pretty exciting way to develop a new audience as well.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
There's one other thing with Theater First that has struck me as a real game changer. Which is your new way of thinking about auditions. Can you tell people a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, when you start going down the questions about artist empowerment, a few things come to mind, and we all can feel that weird feeling when we start thinking about the inequity in the audition process. So together with a dear friend, we decided to start one of our many initiatives. Is called Callbucks, and it just says that especially if you're doing development work, but I'd say this works all the way across. If you're coming in as an actor, if you prepped for an audition, if you're going into the room with a director, possibly a playwright, and saying their words, you've just become part of the development process.
Yeah.
The director's learning. The playwright's learning. You're teaching. You should be paid for that. We pay $15 an hour. And that was something that started 2 years ago. And once we...
I just want to make sure. Yeah. You pay $15 an hour for callbacks.
Yeah, for callbacks.
Great.
Right. So our entire thing that we do right up to this... This new season is going to be different, but this season has been that we've actually shifted our first round of auditions all to video. And that worked out really well because it meant an artist can send exactly the cut they want to send in the time frame that they can need to send it in within, of course, a window. But we hope that gave them a lot of more agency. We also, it's in all the interactions that if for any reason that those resources for that video aren't there for them, that they could come in and we could record it for them.
Yes.
So I just want to make sure that there was equal access across that as well. But up until now, those were not paid. But we felt like that was the best we could do within that. And then anytime you were in the room, you were paid $15 for an hour or any portion of an hour.
That's great.
So 5 minutes, 10 minutes. But you had your BART fare, Lyft fare, gas fare, whatever. But really, the larger part of that is you're working. You have a job here.
Yeah.
And if that at least psychologically could start erasing the space between us on that level, that right. that table that usually sits between us, you know. And it has been, I don't know how we ever even use the word success anymore, but for, you know, it has been so amazingly successful. Just if simply because I get to listen, and I feel like we get to listen to so much more voice now, that artists understand that they are part of a process and their full voice is being asked, not just to bring back these lines, but their opinions, their ideas, their ambassadorship for what they see in their own identity.
Yes, right? They're creating artists, not interpreting artists.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually moved us into the next question. So, well, if we're doing that as a small developmental company with the every once in a while equity contract, but mostly working on this somewhat of the traditional stipend based theater companies around here, that seems like the next thing that needed to go. So with absolutely no preparation whatsoever. But usually the way I do things anyways is like, let's announce something and then figure out how to do it. And so we just announced that we were no longer doing stipends and that all work here would be $15 an hour. I'm happy to say a year later we made it.
You made it.
We made it.
And you're actually changing the way a lot of other theaters in the Bay Area are thinking about their compensation as well, I should say that.
I think that that's the point, right? We've never, you know, we have been accused multiple, I've been accused of so many things.
Only the best things.
Yeah, not so much. We've been accused of pointing fingers at other theater companies. And the only thing they got wrong is we weren't pointing at just one. We were pointing at everyone.
Yeah,
What is your commitment to artist empowerment?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be $15 an hour. It's probably can be more than what you're doing right now. But even the other week at the TBA conference, just talking about, do you know what it is?
TBA is our local Theater Bay Area kind of industry.
Industry conference.
Yeah.
And just talking to them, I mean, so many jaws dropped when talking about $15 an hour. But they came up a little bit when we talked about one of our other wellness initiatives, which is just that there's always food here. There are anytime an actor comes here, there's not just a couple snacks off the side. There is something close to a meal here every night for our actors. And that is done. A board member takes a week.
Wow.
A week and a week and a week and a week. And just the idea that food is there for them.
Yeah.
It's a huge investment into our artists, but the actual capital going out is, $50 a week, something. I mean, that's one of the things, even the call bucks thing, so you go, oh my goodness, you're paying all these actors for this. I was like, well, I think it was an increase for our annual budget of about $3,000. When you look at an annual budget, that's just not that much money, you know. So a lot of these things that can go a long way just take a little bit of thinking and planning, right?
Yeah,
a little bit of risk, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we're I think the whole community here is better for it. I really do.
Thanks for saying that.
We only have like 7 minutes left.
What?
and I feel like I want to ask you a few questions just about like the craft of directing itself,
sure.
because of how much I've loved watching all of the different productions that I've seen of yours in the last 10 years.
Sure.
So I just want to know like a little bit, like what's your rehearsal room like? It's like one of these things that directors almost never get to experience of another director's.
Yeah.
What's your rehearsal room like?
Well, it follows suit with a lot of what we were talking about. Unfortunately, first answer is really attempting to make sure that each rehearsal space is as unique as the story. What does the story need? Not getting caught up in a machine, but building a new machine every time.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that the artists that I'm working with, I understand the strength of, but I rarely have an assistant director because I consider the actors to be the assistant directors. And that they understand that they are more than what is oftentimes the traditional thing of this is what my actor duties are, but I'm looking for an ambassador to that character. And that has so much to do with the casting process in and of itself. Who are the people that we can have the harder conversation? Who can say no to me? Which, it turns out, everyone can. How, and then of course everything has to start right there with those conversations. The best thing that we do, right, is the most powerful thing I think that we do is we create an entire world every time we build a process.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And there are things that go very, very well, and there are things that go very, very poorly. And those stories move forward with those artists. And so the first thing you have to have in any process is, let's talk about what works for you. We'll talk about what, is there anything? I remember doing a piece with Dan Hyatt, an amazing artist around here, and asking this question on the first rehearsal. And I loved that he was able to share, you can give me any note you want, John, but you have to let me do the scene 3 times without you seeing anything more. After 3 times, you can give me more notes. I just need 3 times to work it out. What a gift.
Yeah, yeah.
What a gift to know that that was the way that we're going to translate.
Yeah. Now,
that's the way we're going to translate ideas back and forth, which always leads to a room where everyone feels like they have ownership. I am ultimately an outside-in director. I'm so interested in this cycle of how environment informs us and then how we continuously try to manipulate environment so that it informs us in different ways and gives us different powers and takes away powers from others.
Yes.
And the power and character of architecture, right? Because it's, I think that the way in on all characters is starting with resistance, right? That there are no, that we don't, it's not adjectives, but it's not also like the verbs that we always talk about, but the idea that every piece of me is holding something back. It's a pattern of behaviors that I have built over time in which to resist the things around me. And to know that every moment of my identity is in tension with something outside of ourselves is where I want to start, because I believe then the plays I look for are the ones like, when that is understood, I love the plays that like, and now we're going to try to rupture that resistance. Someone is going to try to rupture that resistance.
Yeah.
And we start looking, we go back to, I mean, we're calling back to so many different traditions, picking and choosing from things. But, you know, hear in the resistance and the rupture, you hear a little bit of the Joe Hawk cue and
things
like that, right? But the idea of continuously looking for, I'm done being part of, and I include being in the audience of, plays up where I am invited to the hot tub of misery. You know, where it's like, come on in, soak long with us. We're gonna be down here in the shit. You know, I have no problem starting there as the resistance, and I want to. I'm going to work, and I'm going to push, and I'm going to do everything I can to inspire an artist to look at their character as how they're trying to get out. How they're trying to move forward, where their hope is. They don't even have to make it. They don't have to make it.
No.
It's that drive that excites me so much about what we do.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's the entrance point for all audience members and all patrons is in that action of trying to rupture. And honestly, the entire process is just looking at that idea from as many different points of view as humanly possible. Understanding that we're in a lab.
Yeah.
That we have a hypothesis as to what this story is. That we have to be able, as a group, be able to get through a full draft of that and go, well, that wasn't it. You know?
Right, right.
That wasn't it. And go back. I've had plays that have, you know, 4-week rehearsal process over 3 weeks have been around a table. And then we're up. I've had pieces that never had any, all the table work was without a table.
Right.
You know, was,
yeah.
It was with stomping around. And, but we're just always after that so hard to define moment of it's not the other side of the burst. It's not sitting in the prep moments of that burst. It's just right in the crest of that wave, right?
Yeah.
And trying to live in this moment and say, and what's great about that is it takes so much work. It takes so much planning and plotting and thinking and articulating and, dare I say, intellectualizing, which I think is probably the death of all art. But
yeah.
To just find this little spot where you know you've got to be when the actors get to do this weird thing, which is play.
Yeah.
They actually get to play in this moment. I'm always after that. However we get there, it's never going to be the same way.
That's the groove.
Yeah, that's the groove.
I think that's a great place to end. I can't believe how fast this went by. Can you share with folks like what you might have coming up either here at Theater First or, you know, you personally directing elsewhere around, you know, in June, July, August, September, November?
Sure. Right now I'm in the midst of working through, I'm the only way you would say, working through Cabaret.
Yes.
With St. Mary's College. And I think this is where a lot of our progressive work needs to be centered right now, as we keep talking about all of the work that needs to be done outside and in our community or
yeah.
coalitions. But to see that, to start inserting that work into our education structure.
Into our Catholic undergraduate.
Sure. And everywhere.
And everyone. I'm just teasing.
So I've been really excited to build and craft a cabaret that is very specifically to start a conversation at a Jesuit college.
Yeah,
And then I'm honored to be directing the Bay Area premiere of the flick.
Yes, Annie Baker's play, Finally Coming.
Yeah, just to live in that world, which each piece just feels like this. Each scene, the most banal, beautiful poem. You know?
Yeah.
And
where will that be?
That'll be at Shotgun Players, which is one of my families.
Yeah.
I'm just excited to be back with them.
And when? What month?
That, I believe. Oh, man. it's late summer.
Late summer.
Late
great.
Summer. And then we're doing a lot of work here at Theater First, we're focusing a lot on anthologies, which is something that we really enjoy doing. It gives us a chance to work with artists from all over the world, working on small things on a common theme, but being able to work that representation into each lens of that theme.
Yeah.
So we're looking at ghost stories from across the world, grabbing them back from Hollywood.
Yeah.
And we're also going to be spending some time just lifting names and actions of Bay Area activists that exist right here and now.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
John, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.